Chapter 8. It was officially spring when we returned to Plymouth Plantation in the year 1621. Now, to be exact, we arrived on March 22nd, 5 days after Somerset's initial visit to the Pilgrims. We landed near the top of Fort Hill, concealed by a number of trees and bushes. As we were about to head downhill toward the settlement, I heard the sound of twigs snapping, and I looked back to see what it was. Apparently, Freedom had heard the same thing. "Did you hear that?" she asked. "Yeah," I said. "Sounded like it was coming from farther uphill." "Well, we're nearly at the top," Tommy said. "Not farther uphill. It came from somewhere up in that tree," Freedom said, pointing to the large pine tree that rose more than 100 feet in the air. "I love those trees," said Tommy. "I'm 99% sure it's white pine. Did you know that white pines can reach up to 250 feet in height, as much as 5 feet in diameter?" Tommy said. "Who needs a nature channel when Tommy's around?" said Liberty. Tommy and Freedom dismounted from Liberty, and we all walked closer to the trunk of the large pine. And just as we looked up, a pine cone fell from the interior branches and bonked Liberty on the nose. "Ouch!" said Liberty. "This forest is now right rude. First I get snubbed by a deer, then I get hit by a pine cone. I suggest we leave before we get tarred and feathered." Again, we peered up into the branches. Sure enough, about 30 feet up was a man. No, a boy of about 13 or 14. He looked tall and wiry and appeared to be climbing down a tree. Suddenly, I recognized who it was. I yelled, "Francis Billington!" My call startled Francis. He lost his balance, slipping from the branch. In a split second, I realized he was falling backward and away from us. My mind raced at the future implications. If Francis died because of the fall, it would be my fault. Francis was seconds from his death, and I would be responsible for changing the course of history. I looked at Liberty, who saw my fear and despair, and suddenly everything on the hill that belonged to this moment in time had literally stopped. A bird had frozen in mid-flight just a few feet from Tommy's head. A squirrel was frozen in mid-scurry as it climbed a tree trunk. Even the twigs from a nearby birch tree were frozen in mid-bend from a recent gust of wind. "Help Francis, quickly," Liberty struggled to say. His voice sounded strained, like he was holding back a locomotive with his mind. "What's happening?" Freedom asked, a twinge of fear in her voice. "This is freaky," said Tommy. "Mr. Revere, Francis he's frozen in time." True to his word, Francis hung in the air completely motionless, no strings attached. He was about 15 feet above the ground that would very likely kill him upon impact. Suddenly, I had an idea. I ran to Liberty's saddlebag and I opened it. "Trying not to blink," Liberty said. "Just a little more," I said. "Try and hold off time for another 20 seconds. I dug deeper into the corner of the saddlebag. Found it. I pulled out a mesh hammock that I had purchased when I thought I might be sleeping on the Mayflower. I ran toward the tree. I called Freedom and Tommy to join me. "Quickly. You two hold the other end. We need to position ourselves directly under Francis and pull a hammock as tightly as possible." "Eyes burning, bulging, twitching," Liberty was panicked. "Just a little more," I said. Just as we finished stretching out the mesh beneath Francis, the air, the forest, the world suddenly came back to life. Francis fell and landed dead center in the hammock. Thankfully, he wasn't dead. The hammock broke his fall as he slid off to the side and landed on his stomach. I quickly gathered up the hammock as Tommy and Freedom helped Francis to his feet. "I'm not dead," Francis said, brushing himself off. "That was a lucky fall. You know, if you hadn't scared me like that, I wouldn't have fallen at all." "Are you sure you're okay?" I asked. "I'm fine," Francis said. "You got to do a lot more than that to take out a Billington. That's what my dad always says. Out of 22 families who sailed on the Mayflower, he said we're one of the few who have all survived since landing in the New World." "You're still alive, thanks to Liberty," I thought. "Liberty," I turned and ran back to him. "You did it," I said, rubbing his nose. Liberty half smiled and weakly replied, "Yes, it worked. I actually stopped time for a few seconds, although I'm still not sure how I did it. It was different than opening the time portal to the past or back to the present. That seems easy compared to this. This was different. It's like flipping a switch in my brain. Although it wasn't really in my brain. It was more like a space between time. It was a place between the here and now. I'm sure that sounds completely ridiculous, but it's the best I can come up with right now. Well, what else do you remember, I asked? Were you scared? Angry? Hungry? What were you feeling? You holding your breath, or swishing your tail, or crossing your eyes? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out if there's a pattern, if we could duplicate it. I don't think I want to do it again, Liberty replied. I mean, it was exhausting. I don't remember feeling scared or angry or hungry. Well, I'm always hungry, but, I mean, you know what I mean. Mainly, I remember sensing danger, having the sudden resolve to do anything I could to help you. Courage, I said. You were feeling courageous. Good. What else? Liberty pondered. I remember keeping my eyes wide open like I was in the finals at the World Championship Staring Competition. I don't think there is such a competition, I said. Well, there should be, because I think I'd be really good at it, Liberty sighed. Anyway, when I finally blinked, everything went back to normal. Francis finished brushing himself off and said, I have to get back home. I need to tell the others. Perhaps you shouldn't tell them about the fall, I said. The important thing is that you're not hurt. Who cares about the fall, Francis said. I'm talking about my discovery. I saw a giant lake of fresh water from the top of that tree. As Francis bolted down the hill, I stored the hammock back in Liberty's bag. No one's going to believe him, Tommy said. I should know. There's no way Principal Sherman would believe me if I had some important news to share. I mean, I know I goof off in class sometimes, but I'm an angel compared to that dude. And I can promise you, I'll never shoot off a musket near a barrel of gunpowder. Good to know, I said, smiling. But from what I know, Francis Billington really did find a giant freshwater lake about 2 miles inland. Just like you said. William Bradford doesn't believe him at first, but finally Francis convinces the pilgrims to scout it out, and sure enough, they find it. And the fish and the fowl that the lake provides become a huge blessing for the colony. Like I always say, Liberty yawned, never believe a troublemaker unless he's telling the truth. We slowly headed down the hill toward the pilgrim settlement. I think I'm going to rest near that large oak tree, said Liberty. I'm exhausted. I'm going to check out the brook, Tommy said. You want to come, Freedom? Maybe you can talk some fish into letting me catch them. I'll come, said Freedom, but I've never had any luck communicating with fish. Well, if you hear the bell, make sure you come straight back, I said. As we separated, I headed over to the houses. As I approached the first one, I noticed the door was open. Inside, William Bradford sat in his chair with his elbows resting on a crude table. He had a quill pen in one hand. He looked to be writing in a small notebook. He also looked to be in deep thought. For a minute, I thought maybe I should leave. But I said to myself, how often can you pop in and have a chat with one of your all-time heroes? I mean, it's one thing to read about the pilgrims and the leader of the first colony. It's another to actually walk through his door and be able to ask him in person any intelligent question you could think of. I softly knocked on the door. William turned and said, Rush Revere, you're always the last person I expect to see, but it's always so good to see you. Come in. Please have a seat. I hope your travels have been kind to you. He pointed to the oak chest sitting near his desk. Thank you, I said. Yes, traveling and exploring have been good to me. I've learned much and hope to be able to share it someday with my history class. I looked around his modest home, and I noticed a fireplace took up one side of the room, a bed against another wall, and a Bible and silver drinking cup rested on his desk. His musket hung from pegs on the wall. I cleared my throat and said, It's great to see the settlement growing. Yes, it's growing, said William, but not as fast as it could. Why's that? I asked. Do you not have enough trees or supplies to build houses? Well, no, not exactly. I can't remember if I told you while we were on the boat or not, but we have a contract with our sponsors in England, the ones who helped us pay for this voyage. And the contract says that everything we produce or harvest, like food, furs, furniture, etc., must go into a common store, and each member of the community is entitled to one common share. Eventually, we hope to make enough to pay back our sponsors in England, I'm finding it difficult to get our people to work. And I pondered his comment. I said, so you're saying that everything that's produced, all the profit, go into, let's say, a box, and then everyone gets one equal share of what's in the box, regardless of how much work they do or how much they produce? That's correct, said William. And some people figure that it doesn't matter how much they work because they're still going to get an equal share of what's in the box. And I can't really blame them. I mean, what is the incentive to work hard if you know the other person will get the same reward doing little to no work? Well, that doesn't seem very fair, I said. I thought about Tommy's football coach and the question he asked all the boys after practice. He said, what would you think if two teams playing against each other get the same amount of points regardless how many touchdowns they make? And the boys booed the coach, and Tommy asked, what's the purpose of playing if nobody can win? And the coach replied, exactly. So get out there this Saturday and play hard. Play to win. There are a few of you who think you don't have to play hard to win a championship. Some of you think you deserve part of the trophy, even though you're not giving your best effort. And I'm here to tell you that if I see slackers out there, I'm cutting you from the team. And if you don't think that's fair, then you don't understand what it means to be a champion. Then the coach led them in the chant, play to win, play to win, play to win. I then thought of the Pilgrims. They initially tried to make everyone winners, but soon realized the attempt was failing because not everybody wanted to work hard enough to be champions. The truth is, when we try to make everyone a winner, no one's a winner. William continued, we thought people would be happy with a commonwealth where no one owns property but rather shares what everyone else has. Instead, the idea is bringing much confusion and discontent. Now, to be clear, I asked, if no one owns property, then you don't own your house or your garden or your business? Correct, William said. I live here, but the house, the garden, or a business belongs to the community, and it has caused many of our people to do less instead of do more. We thought everyone working for each other would help the community flourish and prosper, but that hasn't been the case because men who work harder and smarter are beginning to wonder why they are putting all their profits into a common box, as you say, so that other men who choose not to work receive an equal share of the profits. For the first time since the boat, I can see real tension developing. I mean, any time that I'm in the common house, at least three people come up to me to tell me they don't want to be doing all the work while their neighbor's sleeping. I'm beginning to wonder if the solution to our problem is for everybody to keep what they produce. A knock came at the open door. Sorry to interrupt, said Tommy. Freedom and some other girls started braiding each other's hair, and that's not really my thing, so I came to find you. Come in, Tommy, said William. I happened to overhear your conversation about how some people work harder and smarter, but how others get all the perks. I'm not sure why, but it reminded me of the county fair. Tommy surprised me. I thought for sure he'd tell William about what his football coach said. I'm familiar with fairs. They have existed as far back as the Romans, but what is this county fair you speak of exactly? Asked William. Oh, well, it's sort of this competition, said Tommy. People from all over come to see who has the biggest pumpkin or the best pies or the largest pig, and the winner gets a cash prize, like profits and a cool blue ribbon, and people love it. They work really hard to try to have the best garden. They grow amazing vegetables like squash and cucumbers and tomatoes. My mom makes the best salsa, and she enters it into the county fair every year, and she's won three times. Your mother makes salsa. I'm not familiar with this. Is that something that Somerset showed you? Asked William. Oh, no, but it's awesome. It's this great dip for chips. She chops up tomatoes and onions and chili pepper and a little bit of an herb called cilantro. My mouth is watering just thinking about it. I like this county fair idea, said William. You think we could have a county fair here in Plymouth? Well, I'm not sure if you could call it a county fair, but you could use the idea if you like, said Tommy. I looked at Tommy and I smiled. I wanted him to know how very proud I was that Tommy was the one teaching. We could start by giving people their own plot of land to till, grow, and harvest their own crops on, Williams said. Perhaps this could motivate people to work harder, be more creative with their skills, knowing that anything they produce would be theirs to keep. Perhaps a little competition could be healthy. I agreed. Yes, it's quite brilliant. Those who work harder will likely produce more and then be rewarded more, and those who don't will not. Yes, I like it. I will consider this some more, said William. Thank you, Rush, and thank you, Tommy. Our conversation has been very helpful, and next time we should try the salsa you speak of. The sound of footsteps made us turn toward the door as Freedom rushed in, breathing hard. Indians! Coming down the hill about 4 or 5! A second later, the bell started to ring as we jumped up and ran outside. This time, 5 Indians approached the settlement from Warson's Hill. As they drew near, I recognized that Somerset was leading them. I couldn't help but feel relieved. I imagine William Bradford and the other pilgrims felt the same way. The Indians looked tall and strong. Each carried a bow and a quiver full of arrows, and 2 carried several bundles of fur. Some were bare-chested, and a couple had furs draped over their shoulders. The Indians stopped at the same place that Somerset had stopped during his first visit. Somerset returned with Squanto, said Somerset, the yellow feather still clipped in his hair. An Indian with knowing eyes stepped forward. He held a small bundle of animal skins and furs under one arm. He wore a necklace made of small seashells. His smile was bigger and brighter than Somerset's. I am Squanto, he said. I used to live here in Patuxent Harbor. That was many years ago. I've been sent by Massasoit, the sachem and leader of this land. He permits me to come and speak with you. He will come soon. He is eager to meet you. Your English is extraordinary, said William. How did you learn to speak the English tongue so well? You must be William Bradford. May I call you William? Yes, of course, William said. The ease in which Squanto spoke English was unnerving. It didn't seem natural. And yet, he was a perfect gentleman as he stood there in his leather loincloth and bare chest. Squanto spoke again. We have brought some furs to trade as well as some fresh herring to share with you, a small token of our friendship. Miles Standish, who had also come out to meet the Indians, stood with his armor and musket and said, when will Massasoit be here? Before the sun sets, said Squanto. He comes when he is ready. He could be watching us now. Every great sachem has eyes in all the forest. He watches. He waits. You are fortunate that he wishes to befriend you. Well, we thank you for the herring, said William. I'm sure they are delicious. They are not for eating, Squanto said. They are for planting. If you're going to plant corn and grow a successful crop at Patuxent, you will need to fertilize the soil with these. Squanto held up the herring. Squanto know much. Smart. Listen to Squanto and live long, said Somerset. Me leave now. Long journey home. Somerset is leaving with his men and returning to his people, said Squanto. He is a sachem in the land northward. Somerset nodded. But I will stay, said Squanto. I will help you and do what I can to help Massasoit see that you are his friend and ally. Somerset smiled and found freedom among the pilgrims. He walked up to her and held out his hand. Inside was a leather strap with what looked like a bear claw attached to it. A gift for you, said Somerset. Freedom accepted it and said, a fine gift, thank you. Somerset gave one final look at the pilgrims and then turned northward and left with his men. Freedom turned to Squanto and asked, you said you used to live here at Patuxent Harbor many years ago. Why did you and your people leave? I have heard about the girl they call Freedom, said Squanto, the girl with midnight hair who speaks perfect English. Thank you, blushed Freedom. 7 years ago, I was kidnapped and taken from Patuxent Harbor, never to see my family or loved ones again. I was put on a ship and sailed across the ocean to a new world called Spain. Eventually, I sailed to England, and I learned to speak like you do. Finally, I had the chance to travel back to my homeland. I was eager to see my family, my parents, and brothers and sisters. But when I returned, there was nothing, Everyone was gone. I soon learned that the plague, a great sickness, had swept over Patuxent Harbor and killed my people. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Squanto stopped talking as he stared off into the harbor. He looked sad, distant. "I'm sorry, Squanto," said Freedom. "Yes," said William, "we are all sorry for your loss." Squanto blinked, and a tear rolled down his cheek. "You are kind, and you too have suffered great loss. Many of your people have died from sickness. This place has seen great sorrow for both Indian and Englishman. But I will try to change that. Together, we can learn from each other. Come, I will show you how to plant corn that will grow big and delicious." Tommy nudged William and said, "Sounds like he could give you some nice tips on how to win a blue ribbon for best corn at the county fair." William smiled and said, "I like the way you think, Tommy." As the pilgrims followed Squanto, I called for Freedom and Tommy. "I think it's time we find liberty and return to school." "This has been a great field trip," said Freedom. "No kidding. Do we get extra credit for this?" Tommy asked. "Where did everyone go?" asked Liberty. "I had a nice nap over by that oak tree. You want to hear about the dream I had?" "Sure," I said. "You can tell us all about it as we walk to some place a little more private so we can time jump back to school." Tommy and Freedom climbed on the back of Liberty. And as we walked into the forest to open the time portal, Liberty ended the day the only way a magical horse could. Liberty said, "I dreamed that I was racing from town to town while carrying your revolutionary hero, Paul Revere, and suddenly a giant bolt of lightning struck the ground in front of me. I dodged it just as another hit the ground, and then another, and each time I barely avoided the bolts. It was like Zeus himself was determined to stop our midnight ride. Just before we reached the final town, a lone food cart selling Veggie Supreme sandwiches rolled right in front of us, and I had to make a split-second decision on what to do. Should I stop and indulge myself with mouth-watering goodness, or jump the cart and win the day?" "What did you do?" Freedom asked with great curiosity. Tommy looked like he was equally interested. "I don't know. That's when I woke up. I think an acorn hit me on the head. I'm telling you, this forest is out to get me." "I think you stopped for a midnight snack," said Tommy. "I think you jumped the food cart and saved the day," said Freedom. I pondered both answers and said, "You are a time-traveling horse that can stop time. So I think you did both."